Canmore. Doors will open on the left.
Welcome back to episode 13 of Entering Kenmore. I am David Azer alongside Zach Coe. Zach, simple question for you to start it off. What the hell is going on?
Streakiness is what's going on. It's like the, is it the water boy? We're going streaking.
Oh, that's old school.
Old school. Yeah, I knew it was something
banger,
like that.
Banger movie.
Yeah. That's exactly what it is. And it's frustrating because like, we know that this is what a 162 game season is, and everybody, it feels like everybody always does this whenever the regression or whatever you want to call it, whenever the streakiness returns for the offense, like, well, it's 162 game season. These stretches, like they happen. This isn't our first time watching baseball. We know that these stretches happen. We know that there's streakiness involved in the sport. It does not make it less annoying when you're watching them. Like, this Mariners series was annoying to watch. Some of that White Sox series even was annoying to watch. Like, I mean, we're talking about the White Sox. Like, obviously, we dropped a series to them a week ago. But it's just, it doesn't make it any less annoying. Yes, it's a 162 game season. Yes, these stretches happen. But yes, I'm also going to bitch and moan about it when they do happen, because that's just the type of person I am.
Oh, no doubt. This entire week of Red Sox baseball was probably the most infuriating baseball I've watched this season. And that's not to say that the previous White Sox series didn't suck as well, but you win 3 out of 4 games, you should be feeling pretty good. It's the White Sox, yeah, but they had your number a week ago. So 3 out of 4, you should be feeling good. But even coming out of this series, I did not feel great at all. I mean, we can start with game one and dive into everything from there. But game one felt good. If they kept up this pace for the entirety of the series, then you're coming out feeling a hell of a lot different. They won 10-3 in this game. Hunter Dobbins looked very solid. And not to mention, I think he probably should still be on the major league roster at this point. But Hunter Dobbins, what was his line? So 6 innings, 3 hits, 2 runs. Only one of those was earned. 0 walks. 6 strikeouts and gave up a homer. So for a guy that's making his second major league start ever to go 6 innings, I don't care if it's against the White Sox. That is solid, and you should keep riding that momentum for however long he'll give it to you.
Yeah, and I know we're going to get into the Sean Newcomb start against the Mariners once we get into that series, but like, I felt this way after Dobbins made that start against the White Sox. There's no good reason why he should have been optioned back after when you have Sean Newcomb on your roster. Like, I'm okay with Sean Newcomb. I know the numbers or some of the advanced numbers signal that he's getting a little bit unlucky. I think his FIP is only in the 290 range, which is incredible. If you had told me that, I would have been like, oh yeah, well, like 290. Like, I would have thought that he was getting actually lucky in that he allows more traffic than I think I've ever seen on a major league baseball field. Like, I know people have called him a Dice K, and I only vaguely remember Dice K. Like, I don't remember, like, obviously I was 8, so I wasn't like super, I wasn't diving into the metrics of Dice K starts and being like, oh, he really is allowing a lot of traffic and dancing in and out of trouble. But Sean Newcomb, he allows a lot of traffic. He has, like I said, been a little bit unlucky. But when you look at Hunter Dobbins, it just, there is no good reason for him to still be in AAA. And I know people have also made the argument, well, he's only made like 7 starts in AAA, so like, he could still use some seasoning there. Like, no, we've seen him perform at the major league level twice now at a high level. And yes, it was against the Cardinals, who are whatever, and the White Sox, who are obviously very, very bad. But I'm fine riding that hot hand until he shows that he needs more seasoning in AAA. Could it still come? Sure. But why are we ruling out that this is just a guy who's ready to pitch in the majors right now? Like, it doesn't make sense to me. I mean, looking at the Savant page right now, it's a whole lot of red. It's way more red than you're seeing in Sean Newcomb. The only thing that is in the even gray, which would be league average, his K percentage is league average, the ground ball rate is league average, and his extension is league average. And I don't really care about extension. extension, because all that really is how it, like, it'll increase how fast the pitch looks like it's coming in because you're releasing it closer to the plate. So, like, it's obviously a good thing to have high extension, but, like, there are plenty of successful pitchers who aren't in the 90th percentile of extension. It's just kind of like a lot of it has to do with length, I feel like, rather than like something that you're actually doing. But the chase percentage, 97th percentile, whiff percentage, 76th percentile. The ground ball rate's down, but he's not giving up hard contact. The average exit velo is 81st percentile. So I don't know. I would love to hear an explanation as to why they sent him down. It feels like no one has really asked Cora or Breslow about that. And I know that, like, the average fan, like, if you're doing like a radio hit, like, I know Breslow or Kennedy, one of them every week does the front office report with Craig Hill. But, like, I feel like this is a guy where, like, he's beyond the point where the average fan doesn't care about him. I feel like we've seen him twice now, and the average fan has watched Sean Newcomb go out there, what, now five times and stink up the joint for four of them. So I feel like that's a question worth asking. Like, what more do you need to see from Hunter Dobbins? And I know Giolito's coming back, or like on the brink of coming back, but like even then, like if you just kept Dobbins up to make that start against Seattle over Newcomb and then sent him back down when Giolito was ready, I think that's more palatable than what they ended up doing.
Oh, absolutely. And not to mention that even if Giolito comes back, he didn't show you much when he last pitched in the majors. And he's also been on the shelf for a long time. We've saw, we'll get to it a bit later, but Liam Hendricks came back and he hasn't looked good in, I mean, he got out of a jam, I think it was yesterday, but
yeah, even after still, he walked three guys.
Exactly. He's been walking the world. He hasn't looked great. So who's to say that the same couldn't be for Giolito? I mean, it's a little bit different for a starter, but I'm not, you know, convinced until I see it that Dobbins doesn't deserve the spot over Giolito right now. I get that they have to give it to Giolito because of the contract and because of the missed year, but if shit hits the fan with Giolito, I think you should probably just kick it over to Dobbins sooner rather than later.
And even with Giolito, I mean, look, the last time we saw him in a full season was 2023. He had a 4.88 ERA.
Right.
So this isn't like Giolito's main asset is his ability to eat innings. He had a 4.88 ERA over 184 and a third innings. And I know people said he had some stuff in his personal life going on. And then obviously he got traded and then DFA'd. Mm-hmm. So he was in three different teams in one season after he had only been with, well, I guess technically he had been with the Nationals for the first part of his career, but as a major leaguer, he had only ever known the Chicago White Sox. So obviously there was some external stuff going on there, but I don't know. I feel like writing him in Sharpie as your fifth starter, fourth starter, whatever you want to put it, is a little bit premature at this point. You're right.
Oh yeah, no doubt. I wonder what it would take to get Dobbins back on this roster, because me personally, I would rather see him in a starter role than like giving him the Josh Winkowski or, you know, a long reliever role to just kind of mop up in spots where you're already out of a game. So, I mean, we'll see what could change there. I imagine he'll go down to AAA and probably just prove that he belongs back with the major league team. I don't know if he
started yesterday.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Yeah, I think he was, I want to say he was pretty good. I think Chris Smith over at Mass Live tweeted his line. Let me try and pull it up here quickly. He, I want to say the swing and miss was actually down in his last start, and he hasn't been as good. Like, it's weird because now that I'm pulling up his stats in AAA, he has a ERA over six in Worcester this year, but in 12 and two thirds, here's the game log from yesterday. Was the 24th, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, six innings pitched, four hits, one earned, two walks, three strikeouts.
Yeah, I'm still fine with that, to be honest.
Yeah, it looks like the ERA is being ballooned by his first start. Okay. It was 3 2/3, three hits, five earned, three home runs. So yeah, that's definitely, and then the rest of his starts, I guess two starts, five innings, two runs in his second start, three innings, three runs in his third start. So I don't know. I'm not super concerned with Hunter Dobbins. And like, if anybody, I'm sure that's not what the Red Sox are saying, like, oh, well, his ERA is 6.4 in AAA. But if anybody is like, oh, well, that's why, like, those people are dumb.
Yeah.
But yeah, because like even then, like I was shocked by the number, but then you dive into it and you can immediately see 3 2/3, 5 earned in his first start. So like obviously you're what this is. That was 5 starts in AAA. Mm-hmm. So like his ERA is obviously still going to be ballooned with a 5 spot over 3 innings.
Yeah, exactly. So I imagine that'll level out sooner rather than later. But yeah, the other key story from game one of the White Sox series was Trevor Story, who had 2 home runs in this game. The first one was a bomb in the first inning off Martin Perez, old friend, who actually I think is on the 60-day IL now.
Yeah, I think they said he's going to miss like most of the rest of the season.
Yeah, yeah, which is unfortunate. I always root for former Red Sox guys. Martin Perez also carved us up in the first game he pitched, so it's good to get to him at least in this game, albeit it's the White Sox and you need these wins at this point. But yeah,
I'll always Martin Perez after he was on Section 10, just on a completely unrelated question, was like, you know what? Fuck the Yankees. Yeah. Get him out.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'll always appreciate that.
Absolutely. I mean, Perez Day was appointment television for a little bit there.
Yeah.
But yeah, Trevor Story. So he got the first homer off Martin Perez. The second one was in the 7th inning. It was kind of a garbage time homer at that point. But all in all, you'll take 10 runs any way you'll get them, even if they're against the White Sox. But from there, the series got more interesting.
Oh, wow. We're not even going to touch on Sedan Rafaela?
We could if you want to. I know you're not the biggest fan.
He hit a home run.
Good for him.
But yeah, that was all I had on Sedan. He hit his first home run of the season, obviously.
Yeah.
I already got rid of the stats, but before we pretty much recorded like 2.5 segments before we even hit the record button when we were just yapping beforehand, and I pulled up the stats, but I think he was like 296 in the last 6 games. So he's starting to get it going a little bit. To me, it's still not enough to keep Roman Anthony down, especially now that he's back playing the outfield, but we're going to get to all that. But Sedan Rafaela, home run in this
one. Yeah. One more thing from this game, actually. Carlos Narvaez hit his first home run. So that's, cool. Good for him. Especially,
I am fully out on calling him the Narv. That is the worst nickname of all time.
Yeah.
The Narv is terrible. And nobody should ever call him that. And I hate it.
Yeah.
But also, on a similar note, I never want to see Connor Wong again.
Oh, me neither. Narvaez is much better defensively, and if he can give you a homer or a key hit in certain spots, then I'll absolutely take that in the bottom of the order over Connor Wong, who you could just write down the out in your scorebook before he even stepped up to the plate.
And the biggest thing for me with Carlos Narvaez is last year, the one thing that drove me absolutely nuts about Connor Wong was that he could not block a ball if it hit him directly in the chest. The ball would hit him in the chest and roll like 40 feet away somehow. And Carlos Narvaez right now is 4 blocks above average, which ranks him in the 100th percentile. And we knew that he was going to be a big defensive upgrade over Wong when they originally acquired him from the Yankees. The caught stealing is not great, I feel like, but Wong's not great at that either. I feel like everybody's running on the Red Sox right now. But the framing, 85th percentile. He's not qualified yet for the pop time, but he looks like just a quick eye test says he'll be in the 70 to 75th percentile based on where the slider's at. So that's solid there. But again, 100th percentile blocks above average is such a game changer, especially because it feels like last year there were so many games that got away from them because they simply just couldn't block the ball and keep it in front of them. So I'm all set on ever seeing Connor Wong behind. Well, not ever, but I'm good hand in Carlos Narvaez, the starting catcher role, even when Wong's healthy, which seems like is getting closer and closer.
Yeah, I agree. And not to mention that even with the wild pitches, you still have spotty infield defense all throughout. So if you can have a guy who can, take away some of those wild pitches and make it a lot easier, then it's a great thing to have. And I just enjoy watching him way more than Connor Wong. But yeah, we can move on to game 2 here, which was an experience. The Red Sox, both teams were quiet for the first 4.5 innings here, 4.5 innings. And then, so the Red Sox put up a 3 spot in the bottom of the fifth inning. So looking at this was a crochet start, and his pitching line was 6 innings, 4 hits, no runs, 2 walks, 7 strikeouts. And on the other side, Shane Smith also has pitched pretty solid against the Red Sox. He's the Danvers native, right? I'm pretty sure.
Yes. Yeah, I believe he's the guy from Danvers.
Yeah.
He definitely is because I had that in my trending on Saturday morning.
There you go. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, he's a Danvers native. Just thought I'd throw that in there. He's also kind of carved up the Red Sox. I know I said that about Martin Perez as well, but we're making these White Sox starters look like prime Pedro. Just throughout this entire series, they've been pretty solid. Or Martin Perez, I guess, wasn't great. But anyway, Crochet pitched a shutout through six. Immediately, Greg Weiser comes in the game and gives up a three spot in the top of the seventh to tie the game. And through the next three innings, there was no more runs, so the bullpen was solid. You had Slayton, Chapman, and then Whitlock came in. So all gave clean innings there. Whitlock did have one walk, but you'll absolutely take that. And then in the bottom of the 10th inning, Tristan Casas sort of kind of finally woke up. I know we were talking about the line for the past couple weeks, or the past week still, and it's not great. But he did deliver the walk-off single to win this game.
Yeah, and I, for one, the Nesson, it's amazing. Red Sox and Bruins combined. I don't think anybody routinely has a more terrible TV broadcast
than
both of those teams. Nesson, their quality is just so bad. And every year it seems like, specifically for the Red Sox, there are balls that hit the wall. And like, I know Nesson was just like zoomed in on Benintendi in left field for this one. So no one knew if it was like a pop out. No one knew if it was a home run. No one knew anything. Like I saw people on Twitter be like, oh, like the Casas people are going to be really hyping up this walk-off sack fly. It's like, well, okay, well, it wasn't a sack fly. But like, again, how would they know? Because Nesson didn't show the ball hitting the wall.
Yep.
And like, for me, I had Red Sox team total over what they score. I was a half run away.
Yeah,
so they scored 4 at 4.5, and obviously at that point, the only way to cash that bet was a home run, and I thought it was a home run. So I was like, oh, let's go, grand slam. Like I was pumped for that. But, yeah, so Casas finally gets going. It was actually 1 of 3 hits on this homestand, so, like, obviously nothing to really be pounding your chest about. But another thing in this one, Rafael Devers, home run to get the Sox going in the bottom of the fifth, three-run shot opposite field over the monster. That ball was absolutely fucking shit on. 105-mile-an-hour exit velo, 389, obviously hit the monster. But I did want to bring up Devers' home-road splits because he's just so much better right now at home than he has been on the road, which obviously they're going on the road, which I will get into it in the series preview. It doesn't seem like we're going to be playing a baseball game tonight out in Cleveland, based on some of the conversations that we've been having. But right now at home, he is 14-for-50, 280 average, 2 home runs, 12 RBI, 12 walks, 12 strikeouts, 5 doubles. On the road, he is only 5-for-48, which is 104. Yikes. Has yet to hit a home run on the road. Two doubles, only 3, obviously the other 3 hits are singles. He's struck out 24 times compared to 9 walks. So, geez, I don't know what's going on here with my my body coughing and then the hiccup. But yeah, so obviously it is night and day between home and road right now. And obviously, if you're wondering about the games, it's 14 games at home and 13 on the road. So pretty even split to have that big of a discrepancy of a 176-point difference on your batting average between home and road.
Yeah, that is a little concerning. I wonder if it has anything to do with just confidence-wise at home versus away. But that's something I expect to change. I think Devers has really turned a corner thus far from his dreadful start. And I think he's kind of come back down to earth a bit. Let me see. His current batting average is that right? Is that 194?
I believe so.
I might have just lied that.
Yeah, it is 194.
Okay, yeah. So he has come back down to earth again. I think he started over 21. Then he went on like a week or so heater, and now he's kind
of... When they got back home.
Exactly, yeah. And now, so we'll see this. It could get worse for Rafael Devers. Now, I guess that kind of gets rid of my point. But
this is a pretty lengthy road trip coming up, isn't it?
I know.
August 6th.
Okay, it's Cleveland, and then who else do we have?
Toronto, and then back home for Minnesota.
Right, okay. Yeah, this is... We'll see how that develops, because that trend is not great, especially heading into a week of baseball that you're really going to need to right the ship, or it could get ugly.
Yeah, and when you look across the American League, and I think that's one of the things that like really pissed Red Sox fans off last year in terms of competitiveness, because you look at the American League, like, and I got clowned for this a lot. But the Yankees are not that fucking good, and they weren't that fucking good last year either. Like, obviously, last year they had Juan Soto. This year they don't. But they went to the World Series last year, and they had Gerrit Cole, so they had three good players on their roster. And Aaron Judge was a ghost in the playoffs, and Giancarlo Stanton was good. So you can kind of interchange those two guys. But when you look across the American League, the Red Sox right now have tied for the second most wins with – the Rangers, the Mariners, the Guardians, and you. The Yankees, the Tigers, and that's it, have 15 wins. And then when you go over and you look in the National League, you have the Mets with 18 wins. You have the Cubs with 16. The Padres, Giants with 17. The Dodgers with 16. The D-backs with 14, which when you look at the standings, the NL West is so funny to look at, because you have the Padres at 17-8, Giants at 17-9, Dodgers at 16-9, Diamondbacks at 14-11, and then the 4-20 Colorado Rockies. It's pretty jarring there. But the American League is so weak, and that's why we wanted them to go out and make the moves that they did eventually go out and make to really make a dent in this American League and feel like you can have a chance. And I do feel like we can have a chance. I mean, they're sitting here right now with a -4 run differential, 14-13, two games back of those Yankees. It's going to be about getting rid of some of that streakiness. And I know that they've played, well, I won't even say that they've played good teams. They played some fucking shit teams. Like the Mariners are good. The Rangers are good. But aside from that, the Rays are shit. The White Sox, who you've played the White Sox 7 times now. You don't get to play the White Sox again this year. And somehow, some way, they went 4-3 against one of the worst teams ever. Like, you just need to take care of business against some of these teams. And even going into the Seattle series, it feels like the last two games were very, very winnable games, especially yesterday, where Crochet obviously looked like shit to start, but then he settled in, the bullpen settled in, the Mariners stranded however many guys on base, and the only source of offense you could come up with, aside from Alex Bregman, was an 8th-inning home run off the pole from Carlos Narvaez.
Yeah.
Like, it just has to be better, because you're in a weak American League, and obviously it's only 27, 28 games into the season, but like, eventually you're running out of time to say it's still early. May 1st is rapidly approaching.
Yeah. And I don't want to hit the panic button, because regardless, I'm going to watch all of these games. I have suffered through some of these last week of games, but I mean, you just have to imagine with the firepower they have in this offense, at some point it's going to get going. And then we go from there. Like, I think that you can see the signs. You can see them sort of breaking through at times. Even Tristan Casas getting the two homers in the Seattle series, which we'll get to, is a decent sign. I mean, he's still not hitting great, but overall, I think the lineup has showed they are capable of putting up big spots. I mean, the Cardinals game was cool. They put up 10 against the White Sox, so those are both shit teams. You haven't seen them do it against a good team yet. And once they do that, that's when I'm still feeling pretty confident about this team.
Yeah, I mean, you said it when we talked about that first game. You put up 10 against the White Sox, and you're kind of sitting there thinking to yourself, like, all right, now we go. Like, here we go. This is where the breakout's coming. We're going to come in, and we're just going to bury this shit team for 4 straight games. And obviously, you come out winning 3 out of 4. But with the way that third game went, it ruined my Easter.
Yeah.
And you, like, it's hard to even then be like, oh, okay, well, like, yep, like, you take 3 out of 4, but you're still not really feeling as good as you should be feeling about it when you're playing a team like the White Sox.
Yeah, exactly. And that was a good segue. We can jump into game three for a little bit here. Don't really want to spend too much time on it, but Tanner Houck had a really good start. He pitched six innings. He only allowed three hits, two runs, two walks, seven strikeouts. And the bullpen let him down this game. That is the easiest way to put it. Zach Kelly, I think he was optioned pretty soon after this.
He went down
like a couple days ago, right? I think maybe.
Yeah, he went.
Was it when Hendricks? What was the corresponding
move? That's what it was. He went down for Hendricks.
Okay.
Yeah, he went. No, it was because Dobbins went down for Hendricks. He went down for Mayo.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, either way, I have seen enough Zach Kelly. I know Will Fleming always likes to say that he has great stuff. He just doesn't know where it's going all of the time. And
you can say that about so many different guys. Like exactly. That's what makes, like, especially relievers. So many relievers are down in AAA, and you can say, look at them and be like, oh, they have great stuff. It's just, they can't put all the pieces together. Like eventually that's part of being a major league caliber player.
Yeah.
And we say this time and time again, and I know Zach Kelly, he shows flashes every now and then.
Yep.
And he'll come in and, like, last year against the Yankees, bases loaded, nobody out, and somehow escape the jam with zero runs scored.
Yep.
And but eventually it has to be more consistent. And so far it hasn't been at all. And like, he's even shown flashes of that this season where he's come in and been really good and been really lights out. But then you look up and the ERA is still 9. So yep. Like, maybe he's a guy that is just never going to be able to consistently put it together. And that's fine. You can use guys like that in AAA as reliever depth, but at a certain point you have to say enough is enough and he has to go down.
Exactly. Yeah. I am all set on Zach Kelly. I don't need the heart attack when you kind of expected it from Chapman. And from this point, he's been pretty solid. I think he's maybe had one blow up, but even that wasn't really a blow up.
Yeah, the Chapman, he lost that game against the White Sox. I think it was the Sunday game, Saturday game, one of the two, whatever game they got walked off in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But he walked Luis Robert. Luis Robert stole second. He gave up a single. Yeah. So like, even then, like, I wouldn't necessarily call that a blow up.
Exactly.
It was just extra innings, and like, he walked, or bottom of the ninth, he walked a guy and guy stole second, which we just talked about. Seems like everybody's stealing second against the Red Sox right now. Yep. So like, it's just, it is what it is there. But yeah, Zach Kelly, I think, has been the main perpetrator of the bullpen blowups.
No doubt. I mean, he gave up the lead in two games of the White Sox that you played, because he gave up that other Luis Robert home run, I'm pretty sure.
Well, that one was Weissert, I think.
Oh, was it when Fitz got hurt, right? Didn't Kelly come in?
Oh, yeah, you're right. I thought you were talking about in this series here.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah.
Kelly. Yeah, yeah, that was Kelly.
Yeah, so I'm tired of seeing him. That's all I have to say on him. But then this is the game where Liam Hendricks came back for his first appearance in like 680 something days, something around there.
Yeah, he knew the exact number. It was something like that, 689, 686, something like that.
Yeah, and good for him. I am very happy that he got back to a major league mound and everything like that. Like, I think it's a very inspiring story to come back from what he came back from. And I don't want to get on him too much. He did give up two runs and a homer in this outing, but by that point the game was, you know, not in, I don't know, maybe you should have went to someone else here, but
I understand the like, obviously this isn't like, fuck Liam Hendricks take, because obviously he came back from the, was it leukemia that he had?
I think lymphoma, maybe?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. So obviously he battles back from cancer. He comes back with the White Sox and then made, like, I want to say it was like one or two appearances and his elbow blew out. Mm-hmm. So obviously it has been honestly, it probably wasn't even in a major league game that his elbow blew out, because if it has been 600 and however many days. Actually, no, he definitely pitched for the White Sox, because I remember I was still in Chicago at the time and I remember seeing all the signs and stuff.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. It was a while ago now.
I'll pull it up right now. But also I think that maybe it's just time for Liam Hendricks. I don't want to say, like, with absolute certainty that it's time for him, because I think he is a great personality to have on the team, mm-hmm. and all that. And obviously with what he's battled through, he's also a great social justice advocate, and he's been really involved with the Jimmy Fund, but it has been pretty ugly so far here for Liam Hendricks and his return to the mound, that I maybe just think that for a 36-year-old coming off of obviously fighting cancer and then Tommy John surgery, that we're probably closer to the end of the road than we are him actually playing. And I'm pulling him now. He pitched 5 innings in 2023 for the White Sox.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm kind of on that same line of thinking. I think he's an awesome personality, but you can only give him so much of a leash, especially in these games where it seems like they're kind of falling apart a little bit. I don't want to hit the panic button yet, but these are winnable games that you need to take advantage of, and you can't be blowing leads or giving up runs in every appearance.
Yeah, and they're trying to give him soft landing spots. Right. I mean, yesterday was less of a soft landing spot in a game that was still right in there. And obviously, he eventually didn't allow any runs, but one hit, three walks, and you don't allow any runs in one inning, it feels more like a tightrope act than actually pitching well. And obviously, in the, was it the first game in the Seattle series he pitched in, he had a clean inning finally, but that one was an 8-3 win, so the game was out of hand by then.
Right.
And then, like you mentioned, in his first game, the game was again pretty much already out of reach by the time he got in there. So it just, I don't know, it sucks to see. I'm willing to give him more time because it's only been 3 innings, but like, it just, it feels like the control isn't there and the velocity is kind of ticked back up. It looked, he was in the 96-97 range, but again, like the home run that he gave up to Andrew Vaughn, it was 96, but it was also right down the fucking middle. So like, it doesn't matter if you're throwing 96 if you're just going to put it on a tee.
Yeah, I agree. That was a meatball if I've ever seen one, even if it was at 96 miles an hour. But we can get to the series finale of the White Sox series here, because Walker Buehler has been looking very solid lately, I think, in his last 2 or 3 starts now.
I've got the numbers right here if you want them.
Yeah.
And they just fucking disappeared here. Here we go. They just repopulated quickly. So in his last 3 outings against the Blue Jays, Rays, and White Sox, 18 1/3 innings pitched, 19 strikeouts, 11 hits, 4 earned, good for a 1.96 ERA, and the FIP is only 2.96. Hitters are batting only 175 against him with a 5.02 OPS.
Yeah, that is very solid. I know people are talking about like, oh, Walker Buehler needs to be your number 2 starter. At this point in the year, I don't give a shit who your number 2 starter is. I think if he keeps it up for the playoffs, absolutely he's going to be. But I don't know why it's some like, oh, we need to move Tanner Houck down in the rotation. At this point, it really doesn't matter.
The only times that, oh, this is your number 1, this is your number 2, this is the only time that ever matters is the first week of the season for your opening day starter. And it even doesn't even matter after that to me. Like, I don't really give a shit. Like, that means something that he is the number 2 starting the second game of the season. Like, it can even just be like, that's how it lined up coming out of spring and then going into the playoffs. After that, so many different variables happen throughout the season that can fuck with your rotation. Like, if Tanner Houck goes down and then he comes back and he's ready to go, he's not just going to automatically plop back in behind Garrett Crochet. So it's such a moot point 20 whatever games into the season being like, is Walker Buehler actually your number 2? Like, we'll figure that out when we come to, when it gets to October, and we don't know what it's going to look like then. I mean, it's April 25th right now.
Yeah.
So like, having this conversation is so premature, and like, it just doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me at all. Like, sure, Walker Buehler could be your number 2, and we know that he's a guy that rises to the occasion in the playoffs, but like, why are we having this conversation right now?
Exactly. Something I just wanted to bring up because it's been kind of more of a story than I would have expected. Like, he's pitching great, and I'm happy to see it, but we don't need to be making our playoff roster right now. So
right. I mean, I don't know where they are in the stands, because I've also seen people being like, well, they're not even in a wild card spot right now. Like, again, it's April 25th. I couldn't even tell you where they're at in the wild card. You can't even find the wild card standings easily on MLB at-bat right now. Like, that's how
when does that open up?
I don't know, because I'm looking right now. I assume you can find it somewhere, but like, like, again, like, who cares? Like, if you're looking up the wild card standings right now to be like, the Red Sox aren't even in a wild card spot right now, like, you need to seek help. And like people always say, like, call the number when talking about gambling. Whatever number there is to call for this, you people need to call that number to be like, oh, they're not even in the playoffs right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, Bueller's been fantastic. He's been exactly what you've been looking for. I mean, obviously, we know that throughout the start of the season, throughout the offseason, he was trying to focus on the fact that he wasn't going to be able to be pumping 99 to 100 consistently anymore after the injuries. And it was more about pitchability with him and how he can use his different pitches. This year, he's thrown 6 different pitches. The four-seam, cutter, sinker, sweep, curve, and change. They all have above a 10% usage rate. So he's becoming more of a pitcher rather than like a, what was his nickname with the Dodgers, Butane or something like that?
Yeah, that sounds right. Let me see.
I think that's what it was. Yeah. But then you look at his fastball velo this year is 35th percentile compared to in 2022 with the Dodgers. It was 72nd percentile, which was 95.2 on the average. Before that, even dating further back, it was consistently sitting 95, 96. Now we look and he's consistently sitting 93, but he's still finding ways to get out, which is important, which is something that I don't think he had with the Dodgers last year, at least not in the regular season. So he's kind of rediscovering himself as a pitcher, and it's working out really well, especially over these last 3 starts.
Yeah, and I think Andrew Bailey is a great guy to bring that out of him because he's all about finesse and doing what you do well and honing in on that. So I think it's been a good fit so far. And I know we're only, what, this was his 5th start? 5th or 6th start, yes. I think.
Yeah, 5th start. 5th start overall.
Yeah, so obviously it's early. Obviously it's April 25th, so things could change. But the early returns are looking very solid on Bueller. And if this works out for the entire year, I would not be surprised if he enjoys it here. He rediscovered himself here, and he wants to come back on a longer-term deal. I mean, obviously down the line.
What are the terms on his deal? It's one of the ones with an option, right? Like there's some sort of option deal.
I want to say I can look it up.
I'm staring at his baseball reference page. Let me see if I can quickly find it here in the transaction log. But yeah, I could definitely see that. And that's one of those things like we know the Red Sox have been doing with some of these deals. I would say that Walker Bueller was a little bit less risky of a deal than, say, like the James Paxton or even the Liam Hendricks deal to a certain extent, like because he's younger, obviously, and he had that great playoffs for the Dodgers to build off of. So we'll see what it ends up being. And of course, reference doesn't have.
I think I have it. It's a mutual option. Looks like it's a $25 million option there. But you wonder if he's seeing the success, maybe he opts out of that and just, you know, inks a longer term deal. Who knows? Maybe they would want to just take the extra year and see what happens. But, you know, something
or even just
mind.
Like, yeah, one of those things that they, if this keeps up and they both re-engage maybe around the All-Star break, it feels like that's like the time where some of this stuff, like guys come back together where there's a break and you're not thinking about it. And they just tear that option in half and they say, all right, here's the new deal. It's something that I think they should probably explore with Alex Bregman too, because we're going to get into it in the Seattle series, but he was pretty much your only source of offense yesterday.
Yep. And that is another good transition on your end, because we can jump into this Mariners series, which started off pretty solid. Brian Baio made his return. He looked okay. Admittedly, I think he's still ramping up a bit, but the early returns are solid, and I think it's only up from here for him.
Yeah, it was a really good start for him. I was pretty impressed. Obviously, things got off to a bit of a rocky start. He gave up the home run to, I think, Jorge Polanco was the second hitter in the Mariners lineup on Monday. Second hitter. So he gave up home run in the second inning there, and then he gave up another run in the third. But him getting out of that, it was a bases loaded jam at the second and third. Or first and second, Jesus, I'm looking right at it, and I'm seeing the bases, and I'm like, yep, second and third, that makes sense. He strikes out Randy Arozarena to get out of a jam and preserve a 2-1 lead, and he fucking storms off the mound, pounding his chest. So like, that got me fired up, sitting up there in the press box, being like, let's fucking go, Brian, because like, I'm a big Brian Baio guy, like, similar to Tristan Casas. Obviously, Baio's been hurt, so like, my Tristan Casas honk has come out a lot more on this show than my Brian Baio honk, but I'm right up there with Tristan Casas with Brian Baio. So I was pumped to see him get out of that. And I feel like last year he maybe would have melted in that scenario, because in that at bat, I want to say it was the sixth pitch, like a Rosarena, like he got a fucking nut hair of the bat on the ball for it to be a foul. And Baio already jumped off the mound and started storming off. And I immediately was like, oh boy, well, like he just thought he got out of this. And then it would ended up being a foul ball. This is going to go 500 feet on the very next pitch. And no, next pitch he gets a Rosarena swinging and he does all the song and dance again. So it was really good to see. I'm going to pull up some of the advanced numbers right now on the whiffs and whatnot. But what did you have on Baio?
Yeah, I think he looks solid, and I think to take this with a grain of salt, just because he's still ramping up, like I said. But this is a guy who you had a lot of confidence in last year, and sometimes he delivered, sometimes he did not. He was your opening day starter. That probably shouldn't have been the case, but they didn't really have anybody else at the time, so it is what it is. But this is a guy you don't need to rely on nearly as much as last year. It's a guy who had his ups and downs, like I mentioned, but if you can get the best out of Brian Baio, at worst, he could be your number four starter, your number three or four starter heading into the playoffs. And I know we just said that let's not talk about that right now with Walker Buehler, but it is something to keep in mind that you don't need to rely on him as much. I think the same of Tanner Houck, too. Obviously, he's sort of started to turn a corner here, too. So we'll see. But I'm very high on Baio as well, and I think the early returns are awesome to see. I think it's only up from here, and I think this is going to be a very solid year from him.
Yeah, just even looking at the advanced numbers, something that we saw in his rehab starts in Portland and Worcester were the increase in velocity. The sinker sat at around 95. I don't have the exact number sitting in front of me right now, but I want to say he was sitting in the 93 range last year on that pitch. So for him to be averaging 95 on the sinker, ramping it up to as high as 97, obviously that's a huge increase to his arsenal. And obviously the numbers weren't great in those rehab assignments. And I even had one of my friends who he's a Red Sox fan, kind of tangentially, like he follows the team, but he's not as in the mud as we are with things, be like, oh, do you think I should start Baio in fantasy? I know the numbers haven't been great in the rehab starts. I'm like, well, like, he could be tinkering with stuff. He didn't get a regular spring training. Like, the velocity's up, the swing and miss is up, and that's all I'm really looking for in those types of rehab starts. And we saw it a little bit again here today. Seven whiffs coming in this start. And what's 24 called strikes and whiffs, which is a 25% rate on that. He got four swings and misses on the slider, two on the changeup, and one on the sinker. So obviously you'd like to see those numbers get up a little bit more, but Brian Baio has never been that super high strikeout guy. He's always been a guy that he wants you to put the ball in play. He wants you to put the ball on the ground. Obviously, when you have a sinker slider guy, that's exactly what they're looking for. And that's pretty much exactly what he did in this one.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm very encouraged by this start. I think this is what you wanted to see from him. You wanted to see the improvement from last year, and like you said, kind of in that Rosarena at bat, you didn't expect him to come through there last year, or you wouldn't have. And so this maybe shows that he's turning a corner. He's maybe maturing a bit. I know he had a ton going on last year, based on the clubhouse documentary. His family was, you know, far away from him, and he was in a spot he's really never been before with a lot of confidence from the team riding on him. So I think this is a big year for him, and I'm very confident.
And last year, the pressure was all on him. Like, obviously, we saw how excited he was and to get that opening day start. But, like, also with getting the opening day start comes the pressure of, like, being the ace. And I think there's a difference between an ace and a number one, because every team technically has a number one starter. Not every team has an ace. Last year, Brian Baio, to start the year at least, obviously, you know, Tanner Houck had become that number one, but Brian Baio went into the year as the number one on the Red Sox. He wasn't an ace. And I think people were kind of putting that pressure on him to be that ace. And then obviously you factor in some of the external stuff that we saw in the clubhouse with his family having trouble securing visas to get over here. And Cora actually addressed that before this start. His family's here now. So Good on them for, or good on everyone there to make that happen and get him in a better spot mentally. But then even just going back to the ground ball rate, obviously he doesn't qualify because it's only been one start here, but 71.4% ground ball rate in that one start against Seattle. So mm-hmm. he's pitching to his strengths and also showing an uptick in velocity and swing and miss, which is really everything you want to look for in a guy like Bayo.
Yeah, no doubt. And his second start of the season will be against the Cleveland Guardians this weekend. So we'll see how that goes. But the other key part of this game was Alex Bregman, like you mentioned. He had three RBIs in this game, two doubles. And really, he's been the most consistent bat this far through the season, I would say. I think Trevor Story and Christian Campbell, maybe Willier Abreu too, are hanging around there. But Alex Bregman has been the leader. Yeah.
Abreu's low-key kind of been cheeks for the last however long. And
yeah,
it kind of just goes to, I think it was Lou that said this, like, it just goes to show you what a good start can, like, what impact a good start can have on fan perception. Because right. Abreu obviously got off to a great start, and I'm going to pull up the numbers right now, but he really hasn't done much of anything. He got moved up to that four spot for Tristan Casas, and, like, I can't remember one thing he's done out of the cleanup hole that has been positive.
Yeah, yeah, and they moved him back down too. At least in this game, he was in the five hole. He had three hits in this game.
What would you say? What's a good starting point for his dip? Like that Toronto series? Do you think?
Yeah, probably. That's when everybody kind of started skidding, and yeah, I would say that's
okay. So in those 16 games since the start of the Toronto series, Willier Abreu was hitting .161 with a .266 OBP and a .533 OPS with one home run, three doubles, nine hits overall. So he's struck out 20 times compared to eight walks.
Oh, boy. Yeah, when you put it like that,
not to say like nobody, he's still hitting .270. I think that's kind of what it is. He's still hitting .270 on the season, which I think if you were to tell anybody at the end of the year, Willier Abreu hit .270 with an .868 OPS, you'd be like, oh, great year. Because that is a great year. But when you consider the fact that he entered that Toronto series hitting .483 with a .1491 OPS, and now it's all the way down, that's 600 points lower. Yeah. And again, I'm not expecting Willier Abreu to carry a 1500 OPS throughout the entire course of the season, but water's kind of finding its level here, and it's even more than finding its level because he has been just downright pitiful. His batting average is all the way down to from 420 or 483 entering that Toronto series all the way down to .271. So another 200 point drop. And again, if at the end of the year, he finishes the season hitting .271 with an .868 OPS, you're like, all right, good season. But right now it's a struggle right now because of how hot he started the season.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting because based on his hot start, a lot of people were like, oh, is this the guy? Is this the captain of the team? Is this the face of the franchise? And he has come back down to earth in a big way. But the other key contributor here was Tristan Casas, who had one of his three hits in the past week, but it was a home run in the seventh inning off of, I think it was Trent Thornton, right?
Believe so. Yes.
I don't think it matters that much, but you know, it's tough for me to be like, yeah, Tristan Casas is turning a corner when
Trent Thornton.
Okay, yeah. So it's tough for me to say he's turning a corner because I didn't think this, but when we were talking before the show started, we're like, oh, Tristan Casas has been solid the past couple weeks. We didn't realize that he only had three hits in the Mariners series and the White Sox series, I think. So
yeah, it was six games, three hits, obviously the two home runs and the walk off.
Yeah. So solid three hits, but not enough.
Yeah, but and I think the big thing is he's making a lot of solid contact right now, but he's also he's being way more aggressive than we've ever seen Tristan Casas be in the past. He's seeing fewer pitches per plate appearance than he's ever seen in his career. And to me, that's more of a coaching thing than it is a Tristan Casas thing. Like obviously he's being aggressive, but I don't think that he just magically decided to change his approach completely overnight. Like I think somebody told him like, hey, we want you to be more aggressive early in ABs, because we saw him so much. Just look at, like, at least over the course of the first, what, 2 weeks of the season, he got rung up on pitches at his knees that were probably balls, but he was taking them and they were getting called strikes. And it's similar to what Aaron Judge went through. And, like, again, before everybody jumps down my throat, I'm not saying that Tristan Casas is Aaron Judge, but with guys that are that tall, it's just tough to have that kind of strike zone. And, like, obviously with the ABS system coming into play in probably next year, he's going to be really good there. But I just would like to see him get back into his form of working the count, waiting for his pitch to hit. And, like, there is something to be said with, like, okay, like, pitches down around your knees, like, we're just going to have to try to get a bat on him and live to fight another day. But I just don't want him swinging at the first or second pitches, because that's not when Tristan Casas is most effective, and we're seeing that now. Like, he's hitting the ball, the strikeout rate is down, but he's also not hitting the ball hard. And when he is hitting the ball hard, we see what happens with those home runs and with the walk-off off the monster.
Yeah, yeah. And I wonder if this is a reactionary thing on his end, because it seems like he knows the strike zone a lot better than some of these umpires. Some of the umpiring in this past week has been,
oh my absolutely God, fucking atrocious. Brutal.
Yeah, yeah. Like, consistently terrible. And I know he gets screwed over a lot because of his height, because of his wider strike zone. And a lot of times you'll see him strike out looking because he thinks it's outside, and maybe it's a bad call, maybe it's not. But either way, I think part of him becoming more aggressive is to kind of remedy that. But it's also getting away from his approach that we've seen him succeed in more often than not.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it kind of goes back to something I saw. I want to say it was Jake Wallinger tweeted it. He's been big on the Fire Pete Fatsy bandwagon for quite a while, and he tweeted something from Tim Hires, who obviously was the former Red Sox hitting coach, who decided mm-hmm. to part ways with the organization to pursue other opportunities. I'm actually not sure where he is nowadays, but besides the point, Jake pulled up a story about Tristan Casas when he was a prospect, and Pete Fatsy, as the assistant hitting coach, said, like, oh, who's that guy or whatever, and Tim Hires was like, oh, that's Tristan Casas, he's kind of a hitting savant. And it seems like Hires, or at least the purpose of tweeting the screenshot, was to say that Hires would let Casas go through his progression and stay in his routine that made him so successful, whereas maybe Fatsy isn't. But either way, it has to be better out of Tristan Casas. And obviously we're two Tristan Casas honks. We're two Tristan Casas fanboys, whatever you want to call us. We're believers in Tristan Casas, but I mean, it's tough to defend a guy in Casas who's sitting 167 with a 573 OPS. Like, I mean, this is a guy that before the season started, we were both comparing to Joey Votto or Freddie Freeman or guys like that. I mean, obviously it hasn't been there, but we've seen signs of it. I mean, like I said, the K rate has gone down. I want to say it was sitting at around 27% the last time we recorded a week ago. It's all the way down to 23% now. So he's getting closer, and you can see that in certain swings, like the home run. Like that home run that he hit to dead center, that ball was fucking scorched. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing it in flashes. It's just going to be about letting it click, putting it all together at once, and hopefully we can start to see him turn the corner and let those two home runs and the walk-off kind of start to spark him. Obviously it hasn't to the extent that we both thought it was when we originally jumped on this call to record, but at least you're seeing it.
So Tristan Casas hit his second home run of the series in game two. This was the Sean Newcomb start, which was a very interesting pitching line. He gave up 8 hits, 4 runs, walked 2, but he also struck out 8 guys. So, I mean, a typical Sean Newcomb start where traffic is all over the place and you don't really know what you're going to expect. I really hope this is the last we've seen of him. But yeah, Tristan Casas went deep in this game as well. It looks like it's Legumina. I don't know. Maybe pronunciation is wrong there, but either way.
Yeah, I think that's what it was, Legumina. Fuck him. Fuck Legumina. Get him out. I don't fuck his name. Who cares?
Yeah, I mean, this game was just rough. The Mariners put up 3 in the fourth inning after putting up 1 in the first. And the Red Sox kind of were crawling back late in this game. They put up 3 in the bottom of the eighth. But even still, that was all off the bat. That was all off the bat of Tristan Casas, right? Or was that, that was a 3-run homer?
Yes.
Yes. So, I mean, even at that point, you're like, okay, cool. Like, they're down 3 runs. And I think I texted you about this. I was like, doesn't matter, because Munoz is just going to come in and strike out the side or whatever he ended up doing. But he had a clean inning and closed out the game. Mm. So, yeah, it's kind of all she wrote. With the Mariners pitching staff, it's tough to come back late in games because they have a pretty solid bullpen. And Munoz is a flamethrower. He's been really good for them since they traded away Paul Sewald, and before that it was Kendall Graveman. I'm kind of a Mariners honk. I don't know why I am, but
I am too. I really don't understand why. I don't get it. Yeah, I don't. For me, I think it's kind of because they're on the West Coast, and like,
yeah.
So like the Red Sox games end, and like I'm such a fucking loser that like I'm just like, all right, the Red Sox game ended. Like, what games am I gonna put on the TV now? Like,
yep.
When I'm home during the games, I usually have 3 TVs going, all baseball. I mean, it's a little bit different now because obviously the Celtics in the playoffs and then the NHL right. playoffs. I kind of mix and match what I want, but I think it's mostly just because the Mariners play at night and they're always on after the Red Sox. So like the Mariners and the Padres,
yeah.
I find myself drawn to more than I would necessarily expect to. And I also like a lot of what the Mariners have pitching wise. We missed mm-hmm. him in this series, but Logan Gilbert, he's one of my favorite guys to watch in baseball right now. George Kirby, who's on the shelf. Emerson Hancock, obviously, was a pretty highly touted prospect.
Yeah.
Coming up. He hasn't, which I'll rant about this here in a minute, but I find myself kind of drawn to the Mariners. Obviously, in our preseason predictions, I had the Mariners making the playoffs as a wild card team. And I know I think on this podcast, I've called Jerry DePoto a fucking moron.
Yeah.
And I still think he largely is, even after the Mariners lost the series. But they build their team to play to that ballpark, which is the most pitcher-friendly park in the league. And even then, like, their offense wasn't wildly impressive at all in this one. Like, I'm sure you touched up Sean Newcomb. Congratulations. You want a cookie? Like, whatever. But for this team to get blanked by Emerson Hancock, who entered the game with a 15 ERA. Emerson Hancock comes in 15 ERA. The most batters he had struck out in a start was 5, I want to say. Let me get that exact number here for you. Yeah, 4. So he's made 3 starts. He had a 15 ERA, and he comes into this one 6 innings, 5 hits, 2 earned, 7 strikeouts. The striking out problem has resurfaced, it appears, yep. for the Red Sox.
Yep.
Yesterday, or I guess 2 days ago, they struck out 11 times. Yesterday, they struck out, let me get that number here, they struck out 12 times. It's just too much. And I know Brian Wu is great. Again, talk about a guy who I'm a big honk for, Brian Wu. I really like him too. But like, at a certain point, you can't be striking out 12 times a game and expecting to win baseball games. Like, looking across the board, Devers striking out twice. Christian Campbell had the golden sombrero yesterday, 0 for 4, 4 Ks. It's just, it's not acceptable for this major league team to be striking out at this level. And I'll pull up the numbers right now as far as where they stand in the league. But now, this is now a recurring issue year in and year out. Last yep. year, they were in the top 3 in strikeouts, along with the A's and these Mariners, actually, ironically enough. But at a certain point, it's just like I'm not trying to be a, like, pass all the blame onto Pete Fatsy guy, because eventually the guys have to go up there and hit the ball. But when you're talking about a team that year in and year out continuously is at the top of the league in terms of strikeout and strikeout rate, then something has to change eventually. And it just feels like the easy, like, you're not going to fucking get a whole new lineup. Like, it just feels like the easiest solution is to make a change at pitching or at hitting coach. And I don't think that that's coming anytime soon, which is really frustrating.
Yeah. And just to add on to that, the runners in scoring position issue has reared its ugly head again. They went 2 for 10 in this game, and the Mariners went 6 for 14. Like, that's the difference in a lot of these games.
Mm-hmm. And to further that point for the Mariners, they begged you yesterday to get in. We're kind of crossing in between the two games, but I think they are generally the same, where they were just begging you and begging you to get back into this one. And obviously Casas kind of gets you back in there, and you can say, oh, they were, how can you say they were begging you to get back into it when they were leading 8-2 or whatever it was going into the eighth? Like, they weren't really in that one, but yesterday they absolutely were. The Mariners yesterday went, when I tweeted it, it was like 2-for-11, but they ended up going
3-for-13
with runners in scoring position and 12 guys left on base, and you lose by one. It's just, it's such a frustrating thing to watch. I mean, this, in yesterday's game, you only have 4 hits. You go 1-for-3 with runners in scoring position, leaving 4 guys on, and that's where the strikeouts come into play. If you're just striking out every at bat, then you don't even give them an opportunity to make a mistake. You don't even, if you're not putting the ball in play, then you're not even giving yourself a chance. And right now they're just not putting the ball in play at a nearly high enough rate.
Yeah. And in game 3 of the series, you had an interesting outing from Garrett Crochet, because he gave up 4 runs. He also struck out 9, but he had 5 walks and only went 5 innings in this game. If this is a Crochet dud, this is still a very winnable game.
Yeah, absolutely. And he didn't, like, it was clear from the jump that he didn't really have any idea where the ball was going in that one.
Yeah.
5 walks. And I don't know if you saw the Red Sox stats tweet with the spray chart of all his pitches where he actually didn't have any idea where the ball was going. Yeah. And I kind of got the feeling that it was going to be a weird start after the, was it the wall ball or whatever the leadoff was, the leadoff single, and then he immediately boxed where it looked like he lost his footing. I didn't see a replay of it, and obviously I was up in the booth, so I didn't get a good brag. I didn't get a good look at it. But it just kind of looked like he lost his footing and kind of slipped. But like, I kind of, from that point on, I was like, oh, this is going to be a weird Garrett Crochet start, isn't it? But like, even then, like, he still struck out 8 guys. Mm-hmm. So like you said, if this is what a Garrett Crochet dub looks like, he still left the game in a very winnable position. And then the bullpen continued that on. I mean, you got really solid outings out of everybody that came in. Weissert comes in, 2 hits, 2 Ks in an inning after Crochet. He had the 6th. Liam Hendricks obviously danced in and out of traffic, but like, well, this is what we're talking about and saying that they begged you to hang around. Like, they begged you to come back. They let you hang around. And you just weren't able to get that. You got one of the big swings needed to get you back in position with the Carlos Narvaez home run, but you just weren't able to put the ball in play nearly enough to finally like give them that big blow that they were waiting for you to deliver to win this game. It's just, these are the games that are more frustrating than any of the games, like getting blown out by the White Sox. Like, getting blown out by the White Sox is embarrassing because it's the White Sox, but at least in those games, you've given up on it by the 3rd inning, like the 4th inning. Same thing with that Rays game where Houck gave up a 12 spot in 3 innings. Like, that game's over in the 3rd inning. This one, you're hanging around. It's just like, all right, somebody has to come up and deliver a big swing, and it just never came, and it makes it that much more frustrating.
Yeah, and it just sucks to be on the edge of your seat, because you feel like they're a swing away from getting back into this game, and it just never comes. Also, that Carlos Narvaez home run was 334 feet, and I think only a home run in Fenway Park. So,
hey, they don't ask how.
Yeah, hey, you'll take it. Now up to 2 homers on the year and solidifying his case to stay in the lineup over Connor Wong. I am totally okay with that. I also just want to touch on Luis Guerrero. I think this was his first appearance on the major league team in 2025, and he pitched 2 innings with 1 strikeout. A little bit of hard contact there, but you'll take it. And he's honestly a guy I hope sticks around.
Sam, he had a great spring training. I mean, this was a guy that I thought had a case to make the roster over a guy like Zach Kelly immediately. Yeah. And for whatever reason, they played the roster game. And I know we talked about it in those spring training episodes that your opening day roster is mostly about roster flexibility and how you can optimize your guys with options and things like that. Most importantly about Luis Guerrero, he got Josh Winkowski the fuck out of Boston, which exactly what we needed. And even like, I've become such the Josh Winkowski hater that when he started trotting in from the bullpen, Junior, we're in the break, he looks back and he goes, "Oh, it's your guy, Winkowski." It's like, so even then, it's just like, I've seen enough of Josh Winkowski. He sucks. He does nothing right. He is not good at baseball. He's very, very bad. Yeah. So to see him get the fuck out of here, it's great, especially for a guy in Luis Guerrero, who I like, who I think had way more of a case to be on the opening day roster than some of these other guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wonder if he'll stick around for a while. It seems like they like to mess with options and kind of who's ready to go and who's not. So I imagine at some point he'll get sent back down. But, you know, early returns are solid. I think he has a lot more upside than some of the other guys they like to bring up and down. So I hope he sticks around. I don't know how likely that is, but.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to see. It depends on how, like, the Giolito being activated. Right. I think it'll be interesting to see what they do with Newcomb. Do they give Newcomb the DFA and see if he sticks around and send him to AAA, or do they send Guerrero back down to Worcester and then put Newcomb in that Chase Anderson human white flag / victory cigar shout out at hand role? It'll be interesting to see how they do that. And I'm going to pull up the numbers here on Luis Guerrero, just because this is the first time I'm looking at them. So I'm curious to see what some of the metrics looked like on him. But like I said, this is a guy that I liked coming into the season and coming into his own a little bit. I mean, obviously he showed flashes last year in limited appearances. Yeah, he got five swings and misses in his 19 pitches that he threw over two innings. So encouraging to see there. Most of them came on the slider, but also the four seam. And in terms of velocity, we kind of know what he brings there with upper 90s on the four seam. And then, yeah, I guess we'll see. I would guess that when Giolito is ready to be activated, they're going to keep Newcomb around for whatever reason, and Guerrero is going to be the guy, the odd man out, but yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, it just seems like, why would you move Newcomb to the human white flag or victory cigar role because of the traffic he gives up? I don't understand why you wouldn't rather go with Guerrero or even Hunter Dobbins in that case.
And we know how that ends, because it ends in a game where you're getting blown, or similar to how it ended for Winkowski, where you're losing a game 8-2 and you trot him out there in the sixth inning and say, all right, eat these last three innings. He throws 80 pitches and then you send him down or DFA him the next day to get a fresher arm up to rejuvenate the bullpen. And there is value in that role. Like, shout out Josh Winkowski. You went out there, he threw 80 pitches and he looked like dog shit. Well, he didn't even look like dog shit. He looked like dog shit for the first inning and then let the game get completely out of hand and then came back and struck out the side in the seventh inning, because of course he did.
Yeah.
That role does have value. And like we saw with Zach Kelly too, he threw 60 pitches the day before he got sent down to AAA. So like that role definitely does have value in saving the bullpen. But like at a certain point, like I just don't know why we're going to do that. Like, what is the point of keeping a guy like Newcomb around just to wait until he throws 80 pitches in four innings and then DFA him?
Right. Like, I would rather have solid arms in the bullpen front to back than a mop-up guy. I feel like every team doesn't have that mop-up guy.
Yeah, no, I would have to go through all the bullpens and look, obviously, but I can't imagine that every team has a guy that they just trot out there and be like, all right, wear this one. Like, I'm sure they have guys that they could do that.
Exactly.
But not guys that are solely designated to doing that. And to your point about Hunter Dobbins, I would rather just leave him in AAA than have him come up and be that role, that guy. But yeah, I don't know. I'd rather see a guy like Guerrero, who at least like, you know, he can contribute to this team in a meaningful way further down the stretch than a guy like Sean Newcomb. Like, if he sticks around in Worcester, cool. Like similar to what Cooper Criswell has done. I know Criswell had options technically, but even with that being said, if Newcomb doesn't stick around, once he eventually does get that DFA, you have Cooper Criswell, who can come up and be that exact guy pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. I always enjoyed the bullpen discourse, the Luis Guerrero discourse. I'm excited to see, maybe he makes a name for himself here and sticks with the major league team. But the other thing that has been pissing us both off, I think you will probably get on your soapbox about this, but Christian Campbell in center field, let me have it. I'm ready to hear it.
Okay, I just don't get it. And I know Cora was like, yeah, like, well, we're going to play him how, like, what's it, five games in the in at second base, one game in the outfield, one day off is generally what they're going with on a any given basis. And he's more, he had his, I think it's Hogdale keeps tweeting it, like, Alex Cora when he, like, had the epiphany to put Christian Campbell in center field, like, urethra. and he, like, he said he was more comfortable in center because that's where he played the majority of his games in the outfield in the minors. But here, this one comes from Sedan Rafaela Enjoyer on Twitter. Christian Campbell in four games in center field. 267 OBP, 9 or 696 OPS. I did that reading that tweet pregame or a pre-show too, just where I could not say the OPS properly, with a 66.7% K rate. Christian Campbell in 19 games playing second base. 395 OBP, 783 OPS with a 21% K percentage. Yesterday, obviously, it wasn't just the 0 for 4 with four strikeouts, the golden sombrero. He, in the first inning, completely misjudged a ball off the monster and overran it, and then Duran had to back it up, and it ended up being a double. I'll see, let me see which one that was. And then, obviously, later in the game, was it the seventh inning, eighth inning?
Yeah, one of those.
Yeah, later in the game, there wasn't great communication between him and Willier Abreu.
Yeah.
And Willier catches the ball, and Christian Campbell almost decapitates him trying to do it. He undercut his legs. They both fell. They both hit the ground. And I know we kind of shit on Willier a little bit in this one because he hasn't been very good. But, like, when you're talking about two guys of that magnitude and what they mean for the offense and for the team in general between Campbell and Abreu, like, if both of those guys went, like, even if just one of those guys went down, it would have been a catastrophe. But God forbid both of those guys go down, it's like, holy fuck, now, like, it's an easy solution for if an outfielder gets hurt, it's just Roman Anthony time. But, like, if Christian Campbell gets hurt, what is your plan? And, like, God forbid if Christian Campbell gets hurt while he's playing the fucking outfield.
Yeah,
like, if Christian Campbell hurts himself playing the outfield and he's the front runner for rookie of the year right now, he's been one of your more consistent hitters throughout the course of the first month of the season. And like the fire core of people are already the most insufferable faction of the fan base. Yep. But those people would only be even more magnified and like would even be given a platform or more of a platform than they have now. If that happened, it doesn't make sense to me. And I know we've talked about it before, but you can't say he's a work in progress defensively at second base and at the same time just trot him out there in center field for the sake of getting fucking David Hamilton more at-bats at second base. Like, I don't care about getting David Hamilton more at-bats. You said this about Romy Gonzalez a couple weeks ago, but David Hamilton is actually nothing more than speed off the bench. He's not very good at baseball. So for whatever reason, this coaching staff and this organization has some sort of infatuation with David Hamilton and making it work. And to the point where we're putting a top five prospect in baseball in the outfield, I don't understand why we're so hell bent on this type of versatility. If there's a guy that we want to make more versatile, make it the speed off the bench, not a top five prospect in the sport. Like, how many other organizations are taking their top prospects being like, yeah, we know you're a second base, but how about some center field? How about some left field? Like, there can be versatility. Versatility is important in this sport and in this league, but it's not important among guys that are supposed to be your star players. Like, we should be focusing on building up Christian Campbell as a second baseman and not trotting him out in center field where he's going to almost kill your right fielder.
Oh, man, that was a heater of all heaters. And just to mention in here real quick, Romy Gonzalez has kind of made me eat my words because
he has. The take hasn't aged well so far.
No, I don't care, though. I genuinely don't care. I'm going down with the ship. I just don't like him for some reason. And I can't really explain why. But the Christian Campbell outfield experiment just needs to stop. And if him running into Willier Abreu wasn't a wake-up call, then I genuinely have no clue what will be, because even defensively at second base, it hasn't always been the prettiest, and he's made a decent amount of errors, and he hasn't looked great at all times. So why are you going to mess with a 22-year-old who's still figuring out what you want his primary position to be is second base? He's still trying to figure that out. I don't understand why you don't just stick him there every day. Yeah, let's mess with your confidence even more defensively by putting you in center field. By the way, one of the most complicated center fields in Major League Baseball. You have the fucking triangle out there that makes no sense. You have the balls bouncing off the green monster that make absolutely no sense. And you have right field that's a fucking mile long. So I don't understand.
Not to mention the gate that leads to Bleacher Bar that if you jump into it weird, you can break like all of your ribs.
I know. Like, can we get some padding on that, dude? Like, why? I just don't understand why that's allowed.
Yeah, it makes no sense. And especially like when you, like the defensive side of things is one thing where you say that he's a work in progress at second base, but we're going to trot him out in center field for no reason anyways to, like I said, to get David Hamilton some at-bats.
Yeah.
Of all people. Like what has David Hamilton ever done to warrant at-bats? Like he hit that home run in Tampa, but even then, like that was a Yankee Stadium, like Little League home run. And even then, it wouldn't have even gotten out in Yankee Stadium. That was a unicorn. It only gets out in Steinbrenner Field.
Yeah.
So, like, I just don't understand. Like, this is David Hamilton. He's hitting 0.67 this year in 32 plate appearances.
He sucks.
0.67 with a 2.92 OPS. If your OPS starts with a 2, you are not a major league caliber player. Like, I'm sorry. Like, that is just not – so to be – like I said, to be benching or putting a guy who is a top five prospect in the sport, not just in your organization, in the entire sport, to be putting him out of position in center field to get this guy at bats, being like, oh, we got to get Hammy his ABs. Like, why? So he can go out there and fucking pop out every day? Yeah. Like, it just – it doesn't make sense to me. And it's like I said, like, versatility is good on your bench. It's not good when you have guys that have never played or are still like you are self-proclaiming them works in progress defensively at their primary position. So like, it just doesn't make sense to me, especially when you consider that David Hamilton's only good aspect is his speed. Doesn't his speed play up way more defensively in the outfield than it ever would at second base?
No doubt. And I always looked at him as just a stopgap. Like, just a stopgap second baseman who really wasn't ever good defensively. And, dude, he's from the Hunter Renfroe trade. Like, who gives a fuck? Like, I don't know why we value him so much. It's not like you gave up some all-star to get him. And even still, I don't even think he was the key part of that trade. There was someone else in that deal.
It was Alex Pinellas.
Yeah, and I don't know even what happened to him, but I think
it was some combination of Jackie Bradley Jr. You got Jackie Bradley Jr. or no. So you sent Jackie Bradley Jr. to the Brewers.
Yeah.
And then got back Hunter Renfroe, David Hamilton, and Alex Pinellas.
Okay. Really? That's an interesting trade.
I'm pretty sure that's what I'm fairly confident in that one.
Yeah, I mean, not that it, I was wrong. Not that it matters.
Yeah, not that it matters.
Lot.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense at all. What, like, why they're doing? I did the rant. It makes no sense to me. And I'm an Alex Cora guy, and I know I kind of shit on the anti Alex Cora people, but like being an Alex Cora guy isn't to say that he's completely infallible. I don't think there is a single manager in baseball that's infallible. I mean, even people point to Bruce Bochy as the best manager in the league right now, and we saw him in the first week get absolutely dominated by the challenge system.
Yeah,
like, he just couldn't comprehend that you only had 15 seconds to challenge things. But like, I just think that was not a, okay. So I'm looking at it now. I was a little bit wrong. So it was Alex Pinellas, David Hamilton, and Jackie Bradley Jr. back to the Red Sox.
Ah, yes.
For Hunter Renfroe. But what was the trade that they got Hunter Renfroe for then?
Was he from, what team was he even coming from?
The Brewers.
Was he?
No, the Rays. No, the Rays.
I think,
Rays.
Yeah. I don't remember who they gave up for. Was that the Jalen Beeks trade? No, that was Eovaldi, right?
Yeah, Eovaldi was. Okay, he was a free agent.
Oh.
Hunter Renfroe was just a free agent. But I think there was something weird with, like, they just outrighted him because they didn't want to pay his arbitration or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds like a Rays thing to do.
Yeah, I think it was that. But yeah, so you get David Hamilton, JBJ back, and Alex Pinellas. for Hunter Renfro.
Yeah, like, what a again, steal.
Like you said. And the piece in that was Alex Benellis, because you remember after they made that trade, they were like, yeah, this was Alex Benellis was a guy that we really liked in the draft, and the Brewers just happened to take him before us. So yeah, like, it was similar to what happened with Justin Slayton, where they wanted right. him. I forget what order it came in, but Slayton got, I want to say he was with the Rangers, and he got drafted in the Rule 5 by the Mets, and then the Red Sox traded for him from the Mets.
I think so.
Or yeah, it was some combination of those two teams. I just forget which order it was in.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I think the only other thing we wanted to touch on was Roman Anthony is back in the outfield in AAA.
Yeah, so to me that means the clock is re-ticking on him. Yep. I don't think they were ever going to call him up when he was only DHing, because you have a DH, so you're not going to call him up and be like, all right, you're DHing, and like, you can't play the outfield. So like, obviously he made a sprawling, I don't want to call it a diving catch because it wasn't really a dive, it was more of a sprawl, out and left in his first game back out there. He hit a home run yesterday, and I saw this stat, Milliken tweeted it, let me grab it again. This one was just an absolutely ridiculous stat. It's on his barrel percentage. He would essentially lead all of AAA and the majors in barrels. Barrels this season: Roman Anthony 19, Aaron Judge 18, Pete Alonso, Cal Raleigh, Austin Riley at 17, and Fernando Tatis with 15. So he's just, like, I tweeted it yesterday, but he is more than forcing your hand at this point. And I was all for sending him down there and being like, all right, like, we don't really have a spot for you currently right now, but we're going to let you force our hand. We're going to let you go down there and dominate, and then we can figure it out from there. And now he's officially forcing your hand. And I know Sadon Rafaela, we looked it up before the show, he's hitting 296, I think it was, in the last six games. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, like, that's just not enough for me to keep him down, especially when we're talking about, we just did a whole rant about putting Christian Campbell in center field. Like, you have Roman Anthony sitting in AAA, and you have Christian Campbell sitting in, or you have Christian Campbell playing the outfield. Like, I don't understand it. And I'm trying to find the updated TJ Stats does the sliders similar to Baseball Savant for the minors right now. And I'm trying to find the updated percentage, but oh, here it is. Roman Anthony barrel check. He hit 3 yesterday. Season barrel percentage up to 35.2%. The last time he updated it with the rest of the league, Jace Young of the Tigers was second in AAA barrel percentage at 22%. So, like, we're talking about a guy who is just an absolute monster. Yeah. And he's the top prospect in the sport for a reason. Your offense is sputtering, and I pulled up those strikeout numbers when we were talking about it. Down there, the Red Sox are tied for the most strikeouts in the league with, any guesses as to what team? We mentioned them earlier in this podcast.
Are they briefly, the Mariners?
No, not the Mariners. They were only briefly mentioned, and we both laughed when we read their record. I'll give you that.
Oh, the Rockies.
The Colorado Rockies. The 4-20 Colorado Rockies and your Boston Red Sox have both struck out 257 times this season. The next closest team is the Yankees, 241. So you've struck out 16 more times than the next closest league or a team. And I know people have said, oh, well, like, you have to consider the fact that they've had a bunch of games where they've scored a bunch of runs, so they have more plate appearances and more at-bats than everybody else. Mm. It's still a 24.6% K rate.
Yeah.
So that's good for fourth best in the league. And, like, the Yankees are actually higher than them in the K rate. But, like, that's still not acceptable. Like, even if your counter-argument to their striking out at they have the most strikeouts as an offense in the league is, well, they're only fourth highest in K rate. Like, that's not a good argument. It's like,
no, not at all.
It's a top to bottom issue, and it's not just the only one. Like you said, you mentioned the runners in scoring position thing. That's been a consistent problem too. So, like, eventually something has to change. And Roman Anthony is a guy that he's kind of similar to Tristan Casas. He's similar to Christian Campbell, who, again, like, I know we said that he had the golden sombrero yesterday, but this is a guy in Campbell who, when he's playing second base, has a 21% strikeout rate. And a guy who I just had it pulled up, he's towards the top of the league in terms of walk percentage. He's a guy that's not going to expand the zone. And we've seen that at a very young age, at 15% walk rate. And it's a 27% K rate. But as we said, that's very inflated by the fact that he has a fucking almost 70% strikeout rate when he's playing the outfield. So something has to change. It's a month into the season. You're not changing the personnel on your team. So I think we're maybe getting closer, I hope, to a change in hitting coach, because right now, whatever their approach is, it works some nights, and other nights it's just completely inept. And I'm getting sick of watching this team strike out 10 to 15 times a night.
Yeah, yeah. And it might get more difficult with the Cleveland Guardians, who are kind of a pitching factory. It seems like maybe we're avoiding some of their key starters. I honestly haven't done a deep dive on the Guardians roster at this point.
Yeah, I haven't either.
But yeah, so we'll start with game one, which allegedly is tonight, but that is not going to happen, we don't think.
Based on all the conversations that we've had with people that know more than us, it seems like some contingency plans are already in place and like almost guaranteed to be happening for tonight. And I looked at the weather. It's from 6 o'clock all the way to midnight. It looks like there's going to be thunderstorms in Cleveland. So it looks like we're heading towards a doubleheader tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wonder if that messes with the starters at all. But for right now, game one is Tanner Houck versus Ben Lively.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what we get out of Houck, because it's obviously been up and down. His last start was more good than bad. He bounced back, obviously, but it just kind of feels like I think I cited the Red Sox stat tweet either in the last episode or two episodes ago, where the sweeper and the cutter, I think it was, or the sweeper and the sinker just aren't breaking the same way that they did last year. And it's just one pitch somewhere in the middle and it's trash. But we're kind of starting to see, like, I do kind of worry that this is the Tanner Houck that we're getting from here on out. And maybe half of last year was more of the anomaly than anything, which in that case, like, that's why people have started talking about Walker Buehler potentially being the number two, because he's been so not horrid, but you know what? He's been mostly horrid. So I'll say horrid to start the year. Like, when you look at the Savant page, it's a whole lot of red. We're talking about an ERA at 7.66 too, which, like, again, I said it like with Willier, I said it with Walker Buehler, I said with Hunter Dobbins in AAA, we're so early in the season that, like, a start like Houck had in Tampa where you allow 12, it's going to inflate your ERA for a good bit until it eventually hopefully finds its level. But, like, even so, it's all been bad. And when you look at the four seam, the rise is not where it is, well below league average. When you look at some of the movement on his other pitches, he's not missing any bats hardly, which was a problem that was persistent throughout all of spring training. It's just been very, very ugly for Tanner Houck. The hard hit rate, 50% of the balls hit against him are hit hard. It's a whole lot of ugly. And I know that the Guardians don't have an offense that are going to necessarily light the world on fire by any stretch, but they have Jose Ramirez, which is, like, sometimes it's all it takes when you talk about that kind of pitching staff, which, like, again, like, Ben Lively isn't the greatest pitcher in the world. He's okay, but they just find a way to make it work. And, like, again, when you have this offense that's striking out at such a ridiculous rate, like, it's hard to even say what pitchers are going to go out there and dominate, because they could go out there one day and strike out 15 times, or they can go out there and hang 15 runs. It's just what kind of offense are you going to get? And right now it's what kind of performance out of Tanner Houck are you going to get?
Yeah. Yeah. I am more confident than I would have been a week ago in Tanner Houck. And I don't want to be like I'm out on the guy just because I picked him as my biggest disappointment for this season. You got to see something from him in this start. I think you got to build on this momentum somehow. And I don't know, this offense isn't great. The Guardians are always kind of slap hitters. They don't hit for a ton of power. That ballpark is interesting, to say the least. I know they kind of got rid of, like, a structure in right field that made the made balls start like flying out of there a little bit more. We'll see if that plays any sort of a factor here. But you got to see something from Tanner Houck regardless.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. And I assume that the pitching matchups are going to shuffle tomorrow for the doubleheader. But then in the next one, we got Walker Buehler going back out there against Logan Allen, who is he might be a former Red Sox farmhand. Is he the one that is? Or is that a different Logan Allen? He was in the – there was a Logan Allen that was in the trade for Craig Kimbrell many years ago.
No way. This is still the same guy. He's 26, so I don't think so.
Let's see.
Maybe. I think there was multiple Logan Allens.
Yeah, there must be because this – no, it's a different one. This one was drafted by the then Indians in the second round of the 2020 draft.
Yeah.
Whereas let's see. Who's the other Logan Allen? That must be why it's Logan T. Allen on MLB. MLB.com as opposed to yes, this Logan Allen must be the one. This Logan Allen has a career WAR of -1.2, hasn't pitched. I guess he pitched last year. He pitched 28 innings for the Diamondbacks. Let's get to that transaction page. Yep, there it is. November 13th, 2015, traded by the Boston
Rangers.
Swahi, Javi Guerrera, and Manuel Margot to the Padres for Craig Kimbrell. File that one under the useless knowledge that you didn't know you needed.
Hey, that's a trade tree right there.
Yep, that's what you want. Then he was then traded again 4 years later in a three-teamer with Trevor Bauer, Franmil Reyes, Taylor Trammell, and Yasiel Puig. Wow.
That's a heater of a trade.
That is something. Wow. But yeah, so you'll face not that Logan Allen, but Logan T. Allen.
Yeah.
Tomorrow in some combination. Wasn't very good last year. 5.73 ERA, 1.58 WHIP. This year, it's been not a little bit better. It's been much better compared to a 5.73 ERA.
Mm-hmm.
2.11 ERA in 21 and a third with a 1.31 WHIP. So we'll see what we get. This is a lefty, so we know that the Red Sox are pretty inept against left-handed pitching for whatever reason. I know they're heavy lineup, but that means we're going to get Romy Gonzalez, we're going to get Rob Ref Snyder. They'll probably fucking trot David Hamilton out there for some reason just to find a way to piss me off. But yeah, it's Logan Allen. He isn't a guy that super impresses me. I've never been a huge believer in him, especially after last year. But so far, this year, it's been mostly good. I'm trying to find the FIP here. 2.11 ERA with a 3.53 FIP. So ideally, you see some negative regression on that. On that standpoint, but again, like it's with the Red Sox and a lefty, like this is a guy with a 6.75 Ks per nine, so not lighting the world on fire from that front by any means. But the Red Sox against the lefty, it's just as easily he could strike out 14, and I'd be like, yep, that makes sense.
Yeah, and Walker Buehler, I think, is in a great spot right now. I expect that to continue. And then game three, we have Brian Bayo making a second start, and that is versus Gavin Williams.
Yeah, Gavin Williams is one of their top pitching prospects. I believe he had some injury concerns last year, so he didn't pitch a full season, only 76 innings pitched, 4.86 ERA. This year, it's been 26 innings pitched to a 4.15 ERA with 26 strikeouts. This is the guy that if the Red Sox are going to strike out 20 times in a game, it's going to be a game started by him because the swing and miss stuff is obviously there, and he has the pedigree of being one of the top prospects in that kind of pitching factory that the Guardians have recently been churning out. It's a 9 Ks per 9 so far this year, so towards the upper half of the league. But again, there with the FIP, a 440 FIP, so he's gotten slightly lucky, but more than likely than not, this is what you're going to be looking at in Gavin Williams. But when you're talking about the Red Sox, like it's hard to overstate how easy it is for the Red Sox to strike out 15 times in a game, because we just saw like Brian Wu is a very good pitcher, but like again, he's not like gonna light the world on fire in terms of strikeouts, and he had 8 yesterday.
Yeah,
so it's just it's tough. Like when you're talking about Gavin Williams, he currently sits 77th percentile in whiff percentage at 30.4 and 71st percentile in chase percentage at 30.6. So he's good at getting people to swing and miss and good at getting guys to expand the zone, which are two things that we know that the Red Sox love to do. So like, it's just tough to imagine that they come out of this one specifically in a great spot, even if Brian Baio does give them another good performance, which I'm expecting at this point, because he's been, because of that first good one building off the second half of last year. And I know numbers weren't really pretty in his rehab appearances, but again, I already told you why I don't really give a shit about those, because it was essentially his spring training. So like, I think I'm going to go with 2 out of 3 and we'll see what, we'll see what happens. I know that there's some sort of statistic. I'd have to do some digging to find it, that if there is that doubleheader tomorrow, that teams don't often sweep both heads of a doubleheader. It's usually split 1-1, which if that's the case, then I would not be feeling great about winning 2 out of 3 in this series, but I'm never going to be like, oh yeah, I got them losing. So I'm going to go with 2 out of 3 losing that Sunday game to Gavin Williams.
Yeah. I was thinking 2 out of 3 as well. The only thing that is interesting and might sway my thoughts is Class A, I think, is on the shelf for at least a couple days. I know he hasn't been good, but they have been messing with some other people in that closer role. I think Cade Smith, Hunter Gaddis maybe as well. But I think what I've read is Stephen Vogt is kind of taxing that bullpen early, and that may be where the Class A injury came from, but he's also been terrible, so maybe it's a phantom IL sort of thing. I don't think he's been put on the IL yet, but all this to say, I think I'm still going to go 2 out of 3, but the strikeouts could be plentiful because this is a great pitching staff and a great bullpen. I think if you get to the starters early, you're in good shape, but if you're down late in games, it could be similar to the Mariners series where you're not going to come back because they have so many guys.
Yeah, and even with Class A, it looks like he's dealing with shoulder discomfort. I don't know if that means he's out for this series or what. They didn't really say. But like you mentioned him, Cade Smith has been incredible for them. So it's not even just Andres Munoz, who's a monster. Like
exactly.
I know that the Mariners bullpen did have some success against the Red Sox specifically yesterday. But even like some of those guys that they trotted out there, like Spire
who hadn't given up a run,
or like Snyder, like Trent Thornton. Even like Trent Thornton's not a great example because he obviously has a higher ERA, but some of these guys on the Mariners bullpen don't really strike fear into me the same way that a guy like Cade Smith would for the Guardians.
Exactly. So we'll see. I mean, it's been a frustrating week for the Red Sox. Hopefully we will. I mean, we pumped out like 1 hour 40 and we were pissed off most of the time. So we'll see how things turn out for next week. So we have 3 against the Guardians and then it will be 3 against Toronto. So, you know, a little bit of an avenue to maybe turn the ship around early. We'll see. But as always, thanks so much for listening and we'll talk to you guys next time.
See ya.